Hey, everybody, and welcome to another bonus episode of Horror Movie Night. This week, I am joined by someone who I've been a huge fan of. So when I heard that they were willing to be on our little show, I got very excited. Josie Cotton. Yay, there's the clapping.
I can hear them all.
So you have a new record. It just came out in early May called Revenge of the B-Girls, which I love that it's you doing covers of some of these like drive-in grindhouse schlocky classics.
Yeah, it's called Invasion of the B-Girls.
Oh, I thought Invasion of the B-Girls was the first album in 2007.
Well, no, it's pretty much the same. It's the same. We're re-releasing it, but we added on the additional track, Female Trouble. So, Revenge of the B-Girls would be a great volume two, though.
Well,
I might steal that.
Go for it, and run with it. And I love that you covered the Female Trouble theme, which, I mean, obviously, huge John Waters fan over here. One of his, I think one of his classics that is a little bit much for even the casual John Waters fan, and that's why I love that you did it. Like, it's such a...
I know. I this always kept in my mind, if I ever had a child, I would want to chew the umbilical cord like Divine did. That would be... that'd be the peak moment, I think. But... Unfortunately, I never did, so I didn't get to do that.
So, were you always a fan of like these kind of schlocky films and these horror films, or was this something that came with doing stuff like Valley Girls and Nomad?
Oh no, I was a huge science fiction little girl. I was a weird little girl, and I was just fascinated by science fiction and scary movies, and I would watch them all by myself, and I was a lot like Wednesday from the Addams Family. I was that strange little girl, dark, gothic kind of thing, but that was my escape hatch from the world, and it evolved, of course. You know, I didn't hit the exploitation movies of, you know, all those movies on this record until I was an adult, thank God. But, I've always had this love and, a sense of wonder whenever I would see any of these movies, and then a sense of just absurd humor later on when Russ Meyer came into my life, and it all continued to work for me. So my idea of doing the record of theme songs from all these movies I had loved was, that was really exciting to me. Just the idea of doing it seemed so perfect, and I couldn't believe no one had done it before. That was shocking to me.
Well, and I think that it makes sense for you specifically, because when you look at like the 80s music landscape, you know, camp was always a thing that existed. But, you know, when you're first big hit is a song called Johnny Are You Queer, you're definitely tapping into a very distinct campy style right out the gate.
It's pretty campy. There's other adjectives, but campy is, and it was always meant tongue-in-cheek and in that way. So I'm happy the people got the way it was intended, because that was just a funny song to me. I just always loved it.
So, and I didn't know until recently that was a Go-Go song as well. How did that song come into your peripheral?
Yeah, that we had the same producers. The Payne Brothers were producing the Go-Go's for a couple of years. They were involved in their work and their live shows, and they wrote that song for the Go-Go's when Jane made the observation that all the cute boys were gay, and so that was a line out of a Fear song that they were also working with, that punk band Fear, and they just created this Frankenstein of a hardcore punk and this kind of pop power pop, and they wrote it, and that was the song they would do at the end of the night, and it was their big made them you know, they were known for that song, doing it at the end of the night, and people would go crazy. And then they parted ways, and they were looking for a singer to sing on the demo for their publishing company, and then there come I, and I kind of had to beg to sing that song just on the demo. It's just like, please, please let me sing. I want to sing, you know. And one of them was my boyfriend. He was like, oh, no, no, you know. Even though he knew I was a songwriter and a singer, and he just, I just had to go to the brother and go, it's just a demo. What could happen? What could possibly happen from a demo? And then the demo actually got signed and then caused a huge controversy all over the world. So.
Well, and that was the funny thing was, you know, as I do research before these interviews, I've always loved the song, and I found myself thinking like, oh, I wonder if this song caused a big uproar. And it,
oh, yeah.
And it did, but not in the way that I'm not shocked with who was offended by it, but it wasn't who I thought would be offended by it, is what I'll say.
I guess I knew it was going to be explosive, but I really didn't realize it was going to go to the extremes that it did. Luckily, most people didn't even know that word crossed from, you know, highly forbidden into just the vernacular pretty easily with the whole generation of kids who just thought it was fun. And so the word snuck into our world. But the people who didn't care for that transition were, you know, as you know, the extremely, you know, evangelicals, particularly the ones who had the crazy TV shows back in the 80s, those people.
So did the song, I don't really know the timeline with this, was the power of Johnny Are You Queer what got you into Valley Girl, or do you think Valley Girl is what made Johnny Are You Queer so popular?
No, actually, Johnny Are You Queer was first on this small label called Bomb Records, kind of a very famous, you know, doing new wave and punk rock and whatnot, and it was a giant hit. They were responsible for it being a world, a known international, you know, situation going on for that song. It was all because of this little label. And by the time when I got to my Elektra Records as a major record company, they got very nervous about it, and they pretty much killed the song, pulled it from the radio. It was about to go on AM radio, and they were just terrified of it. And so by the time I hit Valley Girl, that song was on the wane. It was going out of people's consciousness because it had been banned. It wasn't allowed on the radio. It was the record company was trying to pretend it never happened. So I thought it was pretty brave of the director, Martha Coolidge, to put it in that movie.
Yeah, and then you also acted in a little, I feel like it's a very underappreciated movie, but I love it, Nomads, with Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, it was a strange one, and Leslie Ann Down, and from that whole era. So funny, and Adam Ant, and Mary Warnoff. Yeah, that was a funny experience. I didn't know quite how to act as a dead Eskimo that had been transported into a punk rocker, who was destroying property. I mean, I wasn't allowed to go on. I was taking acting lessons at the time, and I just couldn't find my motive for doing this, but.
I feel like that's not one that they cover in a lot of acting classes, is channeling dead Eskimos.
No, yeah, you just can't quite put your finger on that one. But it was fun, and you know, Adam Ant was hilarious, and he made all kinds of wisecracks during the movie. But yeah, and then John McTiernan went on to do his huge movies that he did.
He was Die Hard,
with
right?
Willis. Yeah. Yeah, Die Hard. That was his first movie, and so that was. I think he probably wanted to bury that movie for so long to watch it. I'm kind of guessing that's the situation.
Yeah, but you know what? Us horror fans are loyal to stuff, whether it's a masterpiece or the worst thing we've ever seen. We always find something that we love about it. And Nomads is not a bad movie at all.
No, it's not. And you know, I'm a big horror fan too. I mean, I failed to mention that, but it's funny. I'm supposed to be writing the synopsis of movies. It's kind of a hobby I've developed of writing these re-reviews of these crazy movies and with a little humor, you know, humoristic edge to it. And I was trying to find these movies, and one of them, I remembered it was, you know, with such love, and I started watching it last night. Have you ever seen Tetsuo?
Yes, the
oh,
I can't. Yeah, that is such a weird movie.
It's so weird. It's so dark, and I realized I can't subject people to this. It's such a specific demented mind to. I couldn't even finish it. I mean, honestly, it's so full of just angst and horror and just. This poor guy, I couldn't ever really figure out why he put that metal rod in his leg.
Well, and that's the thing. I feel like there's such a cool overlap of, like, horror and punk rock and heavy metal. Like, it all blends into this perfect melting pot of, what you said, angst. Like, I feel like horror movies get such a bad rep, but they really are probably some of the most genuine, like, unleashing of emotions in a film.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the only place where the truth can actually come out in these crazy movies. I've been watching Black Mirror for so long, but it was always, I mean, it's not quite horror, but it's horrific, and because it's so close to our society now, and all this, but I think you can say things in these movies that you can't otherwise, you're forbidden to say certain things, and definitely, Tetsuo really holds, and Basket Case. I mean, like, one of my all-time favorites.
Basket Case was the first trilogy we ever covered on our podcast, where we did an episode on every movie in the franchise. Because it's you have to see them to believe them. But that first one
have to. It's all, and I've been reading recently about, someone gave me for my birthday book about, you know, famous freaks throughout history, and, you know, it's a Parasitic Twin movie. If people don't know about that, but there were some Parasitic Twins in real life where an actual leg was coming out of one of the twins' mouths, like insane, and they had pictures of it. I'll have to send you a copy. You would really appreciate this book. It's quite disturbing.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah, and that director, Frank Henenlotter, like, the stuff that he's put out beyond just Basket Case with Frankenhooker and Brain Damage. Brain Damage is such a deep movie.
So Brain Damage, that sounds so familiar. Who was in that one?
That's the one where it's like a parasite that attaches to the back of his head and injects. It's basically a giant allegory for heroin addiction. It injects a drug into him and then stops giving him the drug unless he kills for the parasite.
Oh, I got to see that. Yeah. I saw Frankenhooker. I love that.
yeah. Brain Damage is like, because it's as off the wall as his other stuff, but it's definitely like,
really?
It hits a lot deeper than a lot of the other stuff. Like, it's not it has like message tied to it, versus the rest are just kind of like goofy for the sake of being silly. This one, you can tell he was dealing with some real tough shit in his life and was trying to address it.
Basket Case doesn't have a lot of message going on.
Yeah, I love it, but it's not known for its depth, for sure.
No, but its superficiality goes really deep. Like, plummets downward.
So the last thing I absolutely need to talk to you about is, we already touched on the fact that you cover the female trouble on this new version of the Invasion of the B-Girls album, but you also got the blessing from the king of trash, the king of camp, John Waters. What was it like even interacting with John about the cover?
Well, I mean, it was quite amazing. I mean, I recorded it when this album first came out in 2007, it was just a very limited release on CD. And I sent it to him because he had put Johnny Aquir on his A Date with John Waters, Disturbing Love Songs for the Ages, which was such an honor. And to be a part of that movement, I didn't know there was one, but I was happy to be in it. And, so I sent it to him because he had sent me, you know, the one that I was going to be on. And he, of course, he knew all those movies. And he says, well, the only thing is with Female Trouble, I'm in the middle of doing a compilation of all of Divine's songs. So I made you to not put it on this record, which was hard because we'd already finished it and mastered it, and it was like set to go. I thought he'd be so happy, but and of course, I mean, I'm just in awe of him, and I worship at his temple, and the John Waters one, and I said, I will do that, and we took it off, and the record, and so it's been. But you know, in the middle of it, he did say he would sue me. but very politely. He was like an old, you know, Civil War general who's so politely gonna burn down your town or like, I don't know, you know, burn the South down. I don't know, but he was such a gentleman about it. He says, I know you're gonna be upset, but I just have to ask you. People have tried, so many drag queens have tried to record, and I had to sue them all. And, you know, he was kind enough to say, if anyone would want anyone to sing, it'd be you. And whether or not that is true, it was still very flattering. And I said, I could never hate you. I could never be mad at you. And that song actually was extremely empowering for me to perform live. And it's not just for drag queens. And so he said, you're so nice. I'm going to write your liner notes.
Aw.
So, yeah. They're just priceless. Have you read the liner notes that he wrote?
I've read, like, highlights from it, but I haven't had a chance to really sit down and read it.
Oh, my God. It's just, Josie Cotton makes the... has made the unlistenable unforgettable.
It's such a good... That's the line that I know from it. It's such a good line.
And then about Girl in Gold Boots, he called it the hideous sorrow of low-rent go-go dancers. So good.
So the new version of Invasion of the B-Girls is available now. It's on streaming services. And where can people go to keep up with everything else that you're up to?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if people even go to websites anymore, josiecottonmusic.com, but I'm all over, Instagram, Josie Cotton Official, and I have a Facebook and all that type of thing, but it's on all of the venues, and the vinyl is coming out. We never did the vinyl on that record. If any record of mine ever deserved to be on vinyl, it was Invasion of the B-Girls, and it's all remastered, it's new artwork. It's all in a different order, which was strangely enhanced the record. I don't know why, but somehow there was much more of a story, some kind of a horror movie thing going on. I think it's going to be in July that the vinyl is done. People seem really interested, and there's going to be some little additions, but it's available now in all those digital worlds.
On the Spotify's and Apple Music's and all that good jazz.
All that
yeah.
stuff, sure.
All right, well, thank you so much, Josie, for joining us.
Well, this was so fun. I hope to do it again with you.
For sure. When the vinyl comes out, we'll do another.
Yeah.